I really enjoy solving tough problems. I realized as a general manager, that's not most of what you're doing. You're managing people, or you're dealing with current events or sales. My business card said CEO. I thought it should really say sales. I was selling a customer or a hire or an investor. I'm selling all the time. So I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed dealing with the sort of talent that you have in professional services firms. You can't always have the same voice, but there was enough of being who I was that I could keep the sort of iconoclastic viewpoints and say them. Sometimes you need to couch them very carefully. We have a big client and they want the iconoclastic thinking, but you can't push it too far in how bluntly you express it. So that's just being culturally sensitive, right? That's not being yourself. I found that professional services gave me a lot of that, as well as just variety. I've always been just a curious person, an intellectually curious person, and services gave me that as well.
Welcome. I'm your host, Dino Cattaneo, and you're listening to Authentic Leadership for Everyday People, the podcast where we investigate the connection between effective leadership and authenticity. If you're looking for inspiration and tips on how to become a better leader by being your true self, you're in the right place. In our last episode, we talked about creativity, leadership, and TEDx talks with Anna Goldsmith, founder of The Hired Pants and producer of TEDx Portsmouth. Today, our guest is an old friend, business school classmate, and former colleague. Steve Wunker is the founder and managing director of New Market Advisors, a boutique firm that specializes in innovation and bringing new products to market. He's also the author of 4 business books, including Jobs to be Done, winner of the 2016 Business Book of the Year Award. Steve and I discussed his somewhat unusual journey from consultant to founder of 2 successful mobile and tech startups, and then back into consulting. He shared why the choice made sense for him. Steve also worked for a number of years with Clay Christensen, one of the leading business and innovation thinkers of the past 30 years, who sadly passed away a few years ago. So I asked him a couple of lessons that he learned from Clay. And you will hear a beautiful anecdote that really gives a unique insight into what made him special, not just as a business leader, but also as a person. Earlier, I mentioned that Steve wrote 4 business books. His latest one is actually coming out on April 2nd. It's called The Innovative Leader, Step-by-Step Lessons from Top Innovators for You and Your Organization. As you can tell from the title, it focuses on what traits innovative leaders have. And he kindly gave us a snippet with some lessons that you can incorporate right now in your approach. Enjoy the show. Steve, it's great to have you here. Let's start this episode the same way I start every conversation. Why don't you introduce yourself to my listeners, and you can use as little or as much time as you want.
Thanks for having me, Dino. So I am an innovation specialist. I run a boutique consulting firm called New Markets Advisors that specializes in new markets and innovation. And I've been doing this for about 20 years. I'd actually started as a strategy consultant at Bain & Company. I'd gone to be a tech and telecom entrepreneur. And I linked up with a professor at Harvard Business School named Clayton Christensen, who was an authority on innovation, who had published some best-selling books about the topic and was looking to create consulting practices around what he had written about. And so together with a handful of other people, we started a firm to do that. I was with him for about 6 years as we really grew that up. And then I spun out New Markets back in 2010. I speak about this. I write a lot about it. I study it. And of course, I advise on it.
Great. So I'm going to start peeling back in the layers of our career, because you've had some really interesting twists and turns, some of which are not necessarily the ones that are in fashion in the world of business. Specifically, you left consulting to become an entrepreneur. I know a little about your history, so I know that you were an early builder of mobile companies all over the world. And then you decided to go back into consulting. Take me a little bit through that process, your thinking, and how you realized that you like to be more on the consulting side and the other side.
I had to take the tour to understand what I liked, and also, frankly, to just be better at it, too. So I came to consulting at Bain. I'd gone to business school and had been in the public sector before then. I didn't know much about business, honestly. You learn over time, but you learn in a certain way, just creating presentations for people and not being on the other side of the table. It was 1999, and I was consulting with Bain on plastics and metal die casting. And it really didn't fit the vibe of the moment, you know? So I was looking for, how can I get involved in something that's really exciting that's going around? And actually, I left for a corporate job at first because a person who had been a manager of Bain had become the CEO of this British company that was secretly creating one of the first smartphones. And I was at Bain London. We got to talking and I came to head up the smartphone development project. And I was not a technologist. I was not an engineer. But you learn, and what you really learn is how to deal with this incredibly fluid situation where everything's changing all at once. There's tremendous uncertainty, and yet you have to make some decisions. Your team is counting on you to make some decisions. So that was great. And then I left that pretty quickly after about a year because there was so much opportunity in creating things that would run on these smartphones. And people were talking about it, but nobody was doing it. So I figured, all right, I'm 30 years old, probably thought I knew a lot more than I did, but I jumped into it and created one of the first mobile marketing companies. And that went okay. We sold that, but there was a lot else that could be done. And then I took what at least appeared to many people to be a real left turn, and I moved from London down to Zambia to start one of the first mobile commerce companies focused on Africa and replacing cash in Africa because credit cards were barely existent. People thought I was nuts to do that because I'm still running the mobile commerce company. But I had had some experience in Africa and my wife was working in Africa as well. And I saw the opportunity and that actually turned out terrifically well. So it was certainly not a linear path to get there, but that's what I had done as an entrepreneur. And then I moved back to Boston for personal reasons. And I really thought I wanted to be either an entrepreneur or a venture capitalist. And it just so happened that Clay was looking around for people to help create this firm and build it up. And I thought, all right, well, this is really interesting in terms of what he'd done. I had actually never read his work before I had the first meetings. And when I did, I realized this explains so much about why I struggled when I struggled, and some of the things I actually got right, why I got them right. So it was meaningful. Now, at that time, I never thought 20 years after that I'd still be a consultant. But to me, it was a new business, and it was a business that was meaningful to go create, and we'd see where it goes. And then over time, you learn more about what you like, both on the content of the work and the people you like to work with.
In the course of this journey, which like a lot of learning journeys about your career start out with happy or unhappy accidents, but there is a point where you start having intentional points where like, okay, this is something that I want to be a firm in my life, in my career. What were some of those moments from you when you're like, okay, this is really what I want, or these are the things that I want to keep in my career or in my work?
So, to the theme of your podcast, I discovered reasonably early on that I needed to be myself and not somebody else, and that affected the sort of things I would be doing. So, I had run a small tech company, 20 people when we sold it, so not huge, in London, but you know, very freewheeling, casual as it is. And then I moved to Zambia for what was effectively a tech company, it was software. But the business sector is fairly small in Zambia, but it's very formal. And the culture is very hierarchical. And so I faced this decision of, do I change who I am and how I operate? Which very briefly I started to do. And then I realized this just doesn't work. We're trying to do something fundamentally new and different here. We're breaking all sorts of business rules, not legal rules, but business rules as we were doing it. There's a reason why tech companies are fluid and informal, because it works. So we got to operate that way. Plus, it's who I am. So I can't play a role better than I can play myself. So I created what was effectively an American-style tech company in Zambia. And people loved it, by the way. There was an asserted group of pretty young people who really wanted that, and they couldn't have that almost anywhere else. So we got a very talented group. It's a small talent pool, but we got a very talented group of people working with us. So that was convincing to me of sort of the environment that I liked and that I'm good at.
You mentioned earlier some of the things that you did right and maybe some of the ones that you didn't do right. I'm wondering if you would be willing to share some of the ones that didn't go right and what you learned from the experience.
Oh boy, there are a lot of those, right? So early on as tech entrepreneur, it was still during the dot-com boom. And we had a firm that basically wanted to do an acqui-hire and buy us out just like 3 months after we'd been founded, when there was a PowerPoint and a little bit of code, but not a whole lot, for what would have been a really nice sum for me personally. And I thought, no, just 3 months. We're just getting going. This is great. And didn't pursue it. And oh, I wish I had pursued that. Taken some chips off the table. I was 30 years old. There are many other opportunities to have the huge success. Just go ahead and do it and then go see what's next.
That's a great lesson. We were talking about the transition from being an entrepreneur in actually building a tech company to go into a more, it's still an entrepreneurial role because essentially you founded two consulting firms, but more on the services side. Was there a moment when you realized that you liked the services side, and what's interesting about it to you?
So I really enjoy solving tough problems. I realized as a general manager, that's not most of what you're doing. You're managing people, or you're dealing with current events or sales. My business card said CEO. I thought it should really say sales. I was selling a customer or a hire or an investor. I'm selling all the time. So I really enjoyed that. I really enjoy dealing with the sort of talent that you have in professional services firms. You can't always have the same voice, but there was enough of being who I was that I could keep the sort of iconoclastic viewpoints and say them. Sometimes you need to couch them very carefully. We have a big Swiss client, and they want the iconoclastic thinking, but you can't push it too far in how bluntly you express it. So that's just being culturally sensitive, right? That's not being yourself. I found that professional services gave me a lot of that, as well as just variety, which I've always been just a curious person, an intellectually curious person. And services gave me that as well.
You mentioned the interest in solving tough problems and having tough challenges and curiosity. You are also an author, publishing a number of books, and we'll talk about your upcoming book toward the end of this podcast. How much is the intellectual part of the consulting a portion of the attractiveness for it?
I think it's a huge portion of it, and it affects even what we focus on. Look, we focus on new markets, white space, very dynamic industries. That's hard, right? It would be a lot more efficient to just do operations maximization of a bakery and be the world's best bakery operations consultant. But this is very interesting. And we play across four major industries, not just one, which probably would have been a better business decision early on just to do healthcare, which is where we do a lot of our work. But I was afraid we'd get stale, and I wanted us to learn from big tech firms or consumer goods firms and be able to cross-fertilize thinking across industries. I think we are better consultants that way, but it is a personal choice to keep it interesting. It's also a personal choice to play at the high end of the market, where it might be, again, a better business decision to be sort of middle tier and just do very high volumes at the middle tier. that's less interesting.
Earlier, you mentioned you work with Clay Christensen, who's somebody who comes up very often in conversations with business leaders. His book, How You're Going to Measure Your Life, has been mentioned a couple of times in this podcast. So I think I would be doing a disservice to my audience if I didn't ask you, given that you had such a close exposure for him for an extended period of time, what are the two or three things that you learned from him that you're taking with you in your work right now and that maybe some of my listeners can learn?
The biggest lesson, two biggest lessons from Clay, are having a personal moral compass. That was number one for him. And having humility. So I'll give you a story about Clay that illustrates both of those. So there was a time that we had some very senior executives from Korea come over to visit his firm. And they wanted to meet the great man, Clay, who, by the way, was fluent in Korean because he had been a Mormon missionary in Korea. So I had an appointment, went over to his office at Harvard Business School. And he had this little bench outside. And he kept these very senior executives sitting there for 25 minutes while he talked with one of his MBA students who had popped into his office to discuss a term paper. And, you know, of course, at the time, I'm going crazy about this, thinking, oh, geez, yeah, these people have thousands of folks reporting to them in this very hierarchical society. They're used to being treated like royalty. And it was only afterwards that I realized that's Clay. It's Clay because he had his priorities, and education was always his priority. The students came first. And it didn't matter who was outside the door, the student came first. It was also Clay because when the meeting finally happened, he spent at least 80% of the time listening, not speaking, even though they'd come to learn from him. He had excellent questions, but he wanted to learn from them. So he's a very intelligent person, but with a sort of a simple moral structure that's very well put forth in that book, How Will You Measure Your Life? But it came down to me to those two things, which particularly keep you going when you're somebody like him with so many people saying how amazingly brilliant you are. He kept his identity, which was rooted in those principles.
So we had a conversation a little earlier about the choices in how you want to scale and build your services firm and why. And we talked about whether you want to go for growth, aggressive growth, or maintain a smaller dimension. And you mentioned some of the decisions that were being made at the firm you were at with Clay. So I'm wondering if you're willing to share some of that and then how being part of that effort drove you to the choices that you made in your company now.
Well, look, I had been in a range of situations where we would just go for growth. And there are trade-offs you make when you do that. There are quality trade-offs you make. There's lifestyle trade-offs you make. And sometimes, by the way, it's not nearly as profitable as you think it will be. It depends, but sometimes it's not. I decided to create new markets with sort of two major strategies, if you want to call it that. So we wanted to be preeminent in new markets, hence the name of the company, but do that across industries. He's very competent in a handful. So healthcare, financial services, tech, consumer goods, those are our big four. But we do things in education, and we did something recently in movie theaters and, you know, a variety of other things. And that is very purposeful because I think you can learn from so many different areas. Like movie theaters taught me about occasion marketing. It's not to the consumer, you're marketing to the occasion. The date night is different than the play date is different from the girl's night out. You got to think about occasions. And then I can port that to so many other settings. So that was number one, to be consciously multidisciplinary. And then the decision number two was to only basically promote from within. Now, a couple of sections like finance or direct marketing, that's fine. You can get a specialist for that. But for the professional staff, promote from within. Grow your own, which throttles your growth rate. but it ensures you have a very consistent approach to how you do things. You have a very high degree of quality control. And you also keep control of your cost base versus bringing in partners from BCG who, you know, probably very good, but extremely expensive, and do things a different way as well.
That's an interesting point of view, because I think there's a lot in favor of promoting from within. In a firm that thrives of innovation and on new ideas, how do you make sure that you stay open to what's coming in and that it has a voice within the firm if it's all promoted from within and the partners have all operated with the same system for a number of years that's been successful?
That's a really good point. It works if you have a very flat structure and you try to bring in people who have very different capabilities. So a recent hire just got our master's at Columbia in AI and biomedical device design. I did not know there was such a thing as having a master's in AI and biomedical device design. But I want to learn about that. It is definitely as pertinent to clients we have who are in the biomedical industry. But I think we can take that to many other fields as well. There's another recent hire who is a consumer experience designer, and she got a degree in that. There was no degree in consumer experience design when I went to college, I'll tell you that. But she has a lot of capabilities and is outspoken and can bring that competency to many different things that we do.
You casually dropped in the most important part for this to work, which is the flat structure and the fact that if you are promoting people from within and developing them and you're relying on people that are coming in early in their career for the innovative perspective, you need to be willing to give them their own voice and to actually listen to that voice. Is that a correct statement from an operational standpoint?
That is. The trick is you need to balance that with also being able to say, I'm sorry, this slide you made just doesn't work. I know you think it's very clear, but it's not. And here's why. And even if you disagree, I want it done this way. So, but you know, that's much more tactical, right? That's not about thinking in a different way or taking a new approach to something. There's a suggestion we had from another recent hire. So I'm doing a design thinking workshop for people in the UAE in a couple weeks. And because it's a lot of travel, we're fitting everything into 3 days from ideation through to concept testing. And normally we'd spread that out over like 3 months. So we were thinking about, do we send people out for just like person in the street interviews? How are we going to fit this in? And somebody suggested, let's just have them do it all with ChatGPT. Let's synthesize personas on ChatGPT that they can interview and then do concept tests with them. And so we tried it out virtually, and by golly, it works. Now, look, my professional advice is go out and interview real customers. Right? If you're actually doing this for real, do real customers. But for a workshop, it's not bad. I don't know if I would have gotten to that right away. Probably eventually, but not immediately without being able to just listen to different ways of doing stuff.
The corollary of what you just said is that basically the fact that people are seeing you take the best idea when the best idea is there, then makes it easier for them to accept when you ultimately exercise the fact that somebody needs to be accountable.
Well, look, we specialize in innovation. If I wasn't open-minded, I would be the biggest hypocrite in the world, right? So that is a core value of the firm. We are all open-minded and we are unafraid to look at things differently. There was an early hire I made of a woman who she had a decent resume, but what I really found stood out was that she had been a tourist in North Korea. That's who I want. Somebody who is going to go and say, yeah, I could go to the French Riviera, but I'm going to go to North Korea to check out something that is utterly different.
That's fabulous. So I want to talk a little bit about the new book, because you mentioned innovation and we've talked a little bit about leadership. And I know that That's a big focus of the book, which it's coming out in April.
April 2nd is publication date. That's right.
I'm assuming you have pre-ordered links and stuff like that, and we'll put all that on the episode page. What led you to want to write a book focusing primarily on what it takes to be an innovative leader?
The title was The Innovative Leader, Step-by-Step Lessons from Top Innovators for You and Your Organization. This is my fourth book. The other three books were more about the what of innovation. How do you come to great ideas and find them and test them, experiment? What's the strategy for new markets? This is about how do you actually make it happen in your organization? Because look, doing what I do, I see a lot of great ideas all the time. Honestly, ideas are not the problem, Dino. The problem is getting them to market in the right way successfully, or even to make the idea happen and not have people make a big idea really small, because that is just what gets approved more easily. I have seen that so many times. So I think the need out there is, how do people, both for themselves as a leader, but then also for their organizations, make them better at dealing with fluidity, with new products and services, but more generally just new ways of doing business and new ways of working. Organizations aren't good at that. And honestly, it doesn't matter whether they're big or small. Organizations are not terribly good at that. So this book is about people who have done that. And yes, there's some of my own learnings and learnings from my co-authors, but we framed this around 50 interviews of people who have done that successfully, from Satya Nadella at Microsoft, but to a leader in a church, into the head of an independent school, to somebody who's trying to do this at the U.S. Postal Service, to a dry cleaner. So you don't have to be Satya Nadella to have lessons to share.
I want to give people a little bit of a taste, and maybe if you wouldn't mind sharing, I know you have a framework for leadership traits that great leaders who have been able to innovate express. So if you wouldn't mind talking about that framework, so that's something that people can take away from the episode and start thinking about it, and then they can go and buy the book and read more in depth about it.
Sure. So the framework is an acronym that spells CREATE. What we tried to do was boil down what's inherently a very multifaceted style of leadership down to, what are the six things you really need to do to be an innovative leader? So it starts with being connected, C, connected with the market. Because if you're not connected with the market, you might be leading in totally the wrong direction. You see a lot of that, right? People think they're the next Steve Jobs and they've got some vision, but it's utterly disconnected with what the market wants. And I've even seen people who are really good about this still go astray. For another book years ago, I interviewed Jeff Bezos. And it was right after the Fire Phone, which was this Amazon's one attempt to make a mobile phone. And it was an utter disaster. It sold like 30,000 units. And Bezos said, look, I take blame for this. We made a phone that we wanted people to buy because it was good for Amazon. You could point it at something and then find how to buy it on Amazon. But for supposedly a customer-obsessed organization, we forgot about that. So C, connected. Second, role model. People are often very unconfident of their innovation skills. You need to role model those. You need to question things all the time. You need to be observing and experimenting. You need to be evolving. That's the E. So don't get set in one way of thinking or one way of operating. The world is going to change. Satya Nadella was all, when he became CEO, cloud, cloud, cloud. We're going to become the greatest cloud company in the world. And by and large, he's pulled that off. And then in 2018, he really got a glimpse about where AI was going. And he pivoted and said, AI, AI. Now, yeah, AI runs on the cloud, but he made AI his big thing. It wasn't just cloud forever. A, audacious. Google has a rule that you don't want just incremental improvements. You want 10x improvements. So even if we've got a small idea, ask, how can we make this 10x? What are some unwritten rules of business that we are just assuming. And really, if we can let go of these blind assumptions, we can be really audacious out there. That means being optimistic about possibility. So people don't just live in fear of change, actually embrace it. It means being decisive. You might experiment around a little bit at first, but then you know, go for it. T, 360 thinker. What are all the ways you can innovate, not just about the product, but the customer experience, the way you make money, your ecosystem of partners, all sorts of things you can bring together to be truly different in the market. And then finally, E is enable. Because it's not just about you. You've got to make the organization good at innovation too. Otherwise, effectively, nothing is going to happen. So six things.
I believe he's a number six you're talking about of another friend and classmate of ours. So what's her example?
Yes, I bring in Jan Swartz, and we actually have a whole chapter later on dedicated to how she made everything come together for her organization, but for her personally. So, I mean, she's a woman I've always admired, but I probably admired her the most during COVID. So Jan was the president of Princess Cruises. And Princess Cruises has 20 very large ships out there in the middle of the ocean, each sort of their own floating independent city. And at the outset of COVID, three of them had a COVID outbreak. And that was bad in terms of containing the disease. It was even worse because ports wouldn't let them dock. They wouldn't let anybody off. And so here they're incubating disease. People are dying on these ships. And they go from port to port and they're not allowed to dock. So for Jan, this was a tremendously difficult period to get people through. And leave aside the business of, do we think the cruise business is even going to continue to exist? The passengers were panicked. Their families were panicked. The crew was also living in fear. So she did a couple things. She did not hunker down in her headquarters near Los Angeles. She went to Asia to be leading on the front lines. But she also made it clear to the various ships that things cannot be dictated by one person. There is too much going on all at once. And there is no manual. Yeah, there are provisions for how do you deal with sickness, but I mean, this blew everything out of the water, right? And so ultimately, it's about shared values that are going to get this organization through it. And you and your individual ships have to use the shared values that we have worked on for years and manage that appropriately. And that was the message internally that you kept on hammering into people. And look, it wasn't easy, but they got through it. And she got a big promotion after that, by the way, too.
I think at this stage, I may have to invite her on the podcast.
Oh, she is phenomenal. I actually interviewed her twice for the book, and she was phenomenal.
I will use this episode as a pitch. So, for people who are interested in learning more about the firm and the book, where can they find you online?
So, we are New Markets Advisors, newmarketsadvisors.com. That's markets with an S. There's a company that came later and took market without an S, and it's a real estate firm in Vegas. And I cannot tell you how much grief that has given me, Dino. New Markets Advisors. Anyway, you'll find us. We're the innovation firm, not the real estate firm. And the book is The Innovative Leader. The website is innovativeleaderbook.com. And there's not only a background about the book, there's actually two surveys you can take. One is a self-assessment about how do you rate on traits of being an innovative leader. And then we will benchmark you against other people who have taken the survey too. And then the second is an organizational assessment on how does your organization fare according to your perceptions, but you can give this to teammates as well. And you can benchmark that as well. And ultimately, what we'll be doing is allowing people to benchmark against comparables. So marketing leaders at consumer goods companies. And you can see so that you're not just benchmarking against big tech firms, for instance.
That's fabulous. So now we go to the personal part of the podcast. And the first question is, what is an interest or hobby that you have outside of work and how has that informed your work?
Well, I'd say two in particular, maybe three. I am a passionate parent. That was never in my career plan. It just sort of happened. It happened three times, actually. And that has been phenomenal. And I'll tell you, it informs my work, particularly because they're teenagers now, that I listen better than I used to. You cannot manage a teenager like a five-year-old. You've got to listen. So that's been great. I've always loved travel. It's an attraction of being a consultant, actually. We still do it. I live in San Juan, Puerto Rico, which I'm down to my Puerto Rican background. So for me, it's always discovery, even here after 8 years of being here. But we travel really around the world. That's been great. And then I like to read, and I'm curious. I'm reading this history of the Persian Empire right now. We always learn about history in the U.S. from the perspective of like the Greeks defeating the Persians. But really, that is a very small part of the Persian story. So there's so much that we can learn. I actually thought I was reading about the Battle of Salamis when actually the Greeks defeated the Persians and a naval battle. And it's a wonderful analogy for how big organizations, in this case, the Persian Empire, can get so big that they sort of trip over themselves and the fleet-footed can run circles around them and defeat them. I don't know if I'll use that in a business context, but you learn and you think laterally through those kinds of explorations.
That's great. Now, my favorite question of the podcast, and this is where I'm going to bring in your quote from the book. Your book opens by saying there are 30,000 people who write innovative leader in their LinkedIn profile. And I would say that probably not all 30,000 of them are. And then the second part of the, you know, my question is there are expressions in the business world that become cliches or become overused and at some point they become meaningless. And actually, you know, you are the authors of a couple of books that have created some of these expressions like jobs to be done, which is often misused. But what is one expression that drives you crazy right now?
So related to the topic of the book, culture of innovation. We have a whole chapter on culture. Culture matters, but I don't know what a culture of innovation is. And look, if anybody should know, you know, I should know. It is a tremendously vague term, and it suggests that innovation is an end in itself. It is not. If you don't know why you're innovating, you got problems. So yes, culture matters in an organization, but it is multifaceted. A culture of action, okay, I get that. But culture innovation is a frustratingly common term that gives people license to either say, well, we don't have one, we're never going to be that way, or to excuse all sorts of nonsense behavior because it is somehow promoting innovation when really it doesn't sustainably do that. It's a little flash in the pan that will just get people cynical at the end.
Fabulous. Final question. I call it food for the body or food for the soul. You can either choose one or say both, depending on how inspired you are by the question. But food for the body is a food, a recipe, or a drink that right now you feel it's like a nourishing drink for you. Or if we go the soul route, anything that's artistic, it can be a book, piece of music, a movie, a piece of theater, TV show, sculpture, art, whatever, something that right now is meaningful to you.
All right. So I'll give you a food for the soul. One reason I do what I do is because I really value creativity. I think it's one of the things that makes us human. And so I love creative arts. I was surprised coming to Puerto Rico and how much artistic ferment there is here. It's actually a culinary ferment too. We have some really outstanding restaurants. But in terms of the visual arts, there is so much that goes on in different ways. So street art, for instance. There's not a lot of money in Puerto Rico. There's not a lot of people buying commissioned pieces. But people are out there doing street art. The person who painted this office that I'm in, painted our logo on the wall, said, well, you know, I do like real paintings too. And I thought, really? And so at first he did a couple collages of different farm animals, which was not what I expected, but I just said, go to it. Show me what you can do. And then he did more graffiti-inspired images. And for that, he asked, okay, what do you want it to be about? One was about female empowerment. One was about cooking. One was about wine and dining. But it was so different than what I would see in Boston or in London, wherever. I loved it. So you often find the artistic ferment on the edge. It's not in the center. It's something I really value about Puerto Rico. It's another art form I've gotten into is tapestry. Latin America, not so much Puerto Rico, but like the Andean countries, make these phenomenal tapestries. I actually saw that in Lesotho in Southern Africa as well. Phenomenal tapestries that bring this three-dimensionality to art and this mix of colors you just can't get in other media. So I love what it is. I also love that it's different.
Fabulous. Steve, thank you so much for coming on the episode, for all your insights, and good luck with the book.
Thanks so much. Pleasure, Dino. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, find a friend who may like it and tell them that they should listen to it. Also, you may have listened to every single episode so far, in which case I'm really thankful. But most likely you haven't. So go back and find a few others and listen to them. And if you really like the show, tell all your friends and post about it on social media. Every little bit helps. Make sure you subscribe to the show on your favorite listening platform so you don't miss any episode. And if you listen on a platform that allows ratings and reviews like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, Good Pods, please leave us a stellar rating and a review. 5 stars. Stay tuned because after the credits, I will play a song by Honest Mechanic, the indie folk duo that is made of Susan Cattaneo, one of Boston's best Americana singer-songwriters, and Paul Hanson from the band The Grown Up Noise. For more information on the episode and all the links, go to the website al4ep.com, spelled with the number 4. You can email me at dino@al4ep.com. Also, please make sure that you follow us on whatever social platform you're engaged on. On Twitter and Instagram, the handle is @al4edp with the letter D, and on Facebook, you can look for Authentic Leadership for Everyday People. This episode was produced by me, Dino Cattaneo, and it was recorded remotely with Squadcast and partially edited in Descript, with additional edits by Pro Podcast Solutions. The theme music was composed, produced, arranged, and recorded by Nicolas Cattaneo, who also played keyboards and drums, with Tony Savarino on guitar and Jesse Williams on bass. And now, here is a song by Honest Mechanic. It's called Maybe.
Maybe we could slowly fall back into love. Maybe it's been known to happen, look it up. Maybe love, see how our light.
I'm caught in a free-falling spin.
Slowly fall back.